ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Andy Burnham pitched himself as an outsider, not in that sort of populist way of saying I'm against the elites, but I'm from another part of the UK which perfectly well understands the cost of living crisis. Give me a chance to do this nationally.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
A nationwide Telstra outage has caused chaos for commuters and businesses and individuals, impacting regional transport services and payment systems across the country. As services come back online, concerns remain over the possible impact of the outage on 000 calls. And artificial intelligence is back in the spotlight, with Andrew Charlton suggesting regulating safety for AI can act as an enabler, not a brake. So will we see a more interventionist approach from the Albanese government? Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Karvelas.
And I'm Claire Armstrong, and welcome back, PK.
Thank you. I did get some snow, everyone.
Yay, that's really good, because as I was saying before, Perisher was looking pretty dire in the clips I was seeing on Instagram a couple of days before you went.
I know, I did think, I was like, the gods were like, I know, we'll just give her a little bit of snow so that she can go down the mountain with her children in her couple of days off. So anyway, I'm back in chilly Canberra with you, which is a place I love to be, and no snow here. But let's talk about the Telstra outage, and just it's important to always be radically honest with your listeners. I'm particularly enraged by this because I'm on Telstra.
Me too.
And this morning was a cluster, add the other word, for me in setting up this and my other show, and I'm hosting Insiders on the weekend. All the things I do, I could not do my own productivity. Now, I know that is very selfish, but the reason I'm saying it is, if in my little minor journo world it was so annoying, what has it done to our systems? It's impacted mobile and data connectivity, payment systems, transport, regional train services in Victoria and New South Wales. Basically, the train that goes from Sydney to Canberra wasn't operating. That's seriously, the impact on productivity for our country, huge. And of course, life and death with 000, which we'll get into. The Telstra CFO, Michael Ackland, says that has been intermittent, but nationwide, it was huge. Claire, talk me through it. This is huge, and it comes off the back, of course, of the Optus dramas.
Yeah, I think as we record this, the latest from Telstra is about 90% of services are back online. But Telstra is obviously a huge service provider, and it also underpins a lot of people. Like, people might not have necessarily realised that the mobile provider they use actually rents off or piggybacks off of Telstra. So obviously a huge impact just in terms of the volume of people, businesses, etc. affected. But coming off the back of really years of these things, particularly with the Optus outage, I think everyone is a lot more anxious and a lot more nervous. We know from previous outages, there's been investigations into deaths linked to people who were unable to get through to 000. So it has very real world, serious personal impacts as well. And I think, you know, with very much still in the early stages, the message from Telstra's CFO, terrible timing for the CEO to be on leave, as is our communications minister, Annika Wells. I bet she's having a pretty terrible day as well, although she's being filled in for by Christy McBain, who's acting communications minister at the moment. But, you know, it's that really kind of bad timing for needing really strong comms here. I don't think we're in a situation that we were with Optus. I imagine the large volumes of money that would have been spent by Telstra, having watched Optus go through its, you know, situation multiple times of failing on the comms, failing on systems, I'm guessing they're feeling that investment was pretty well worth it. We've sort of had a fairly constant stream of communications from the telco. I think it will get more and more political, though, as we get away from the immediate crisis response. And we've already seen some interesting commentary from the coalition ranging from immediately trying to link it to a security issue, the recency of the China missile test.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So that first was raised, and I say first, I haven't fact-checked that, but the kind of early on today by Barnaby Joyce, One Nation MP, sort of saying, hey, you know, how about that? I don't know. Now, that's the old, I got to say, that we've gotten into a culture now a bit of you raise something, you admit you don't know, but you've put it into the ether. Then the actual opposition leader, Angus Taylor, said, and I quote, "We saw a provocative and unwelcome missile launch from the PLA yesterday, and I can understand why Australians are drawing that connection. Now, I don't know whether there's any connection."
Yeah, that was surprising.
I'm not saying... I don't know, but we don't have any evidence.
No. And I would say there are probably members of Angus Taylor's front bench who, if we were to ask them right now, they would run a mile from linking those two, as far as we know, unrelated, but just happening around the same time events.
Mm. Well, we've got to, it's almost sort of the way average people, I'm putting myself in that category, kind of stand around a water cooler, so to speak, and go, hey, it's pretty funny timing, right? It's generally not what the most senior people in the country are meant to do, though.
No.
You know, you can spitball with your mates, hey, timing, but that's not facts. And it is a little odd if you're as senior as an opposition leader to raise it without something, you know, something having emerged, someone whistleblowing and saying, well, you know what I mean? Something.
Yeah,
you
even
need
an
to
expert
have something
speculating that you can lean to. Speaking of senior people, maybe getting ahead of themselves in relation to this, I think we'll find that Shadow Communications Minister Sarah Henderson has probably got a bit of cleaning up to do. She was on television this morning talking about the outage, in which she noted there'd been reports of some emergency services having issues with connectivity. So she thought, why not test it out for herself, and owned to making calls to 000 just to see if she'd get through. Which might surprise some people, given Telstra was putting out messaging saying, please don't unnecessarily call 000. That is not a great use of whatever connectivity is available. And subsequent to that, Angus Taylor was asked, you know, is it appropriate that your frontbencher is testing 000? I don't know what her plan was. If she got through, was she just going to say thank you for your service and hang up again? I'm really not sure that's the best use of anyone's time. Angus Taylor said, well, of course, people are going to be investigating for themselves, you know, if this thing really isn't working. It was then up to one of our plucky ABC reporters to point out that it is a Commonwealth offence to call 000 without a reason to, without being in an emergency, to which Taylor reverted to the script of he would encourage people not to unnecessarily call 000.
Yep. Okay. I'm glad once the actual federal law was shared with him, he was able to broadly back in a federal law that no doubt they actually backed at the time. You know what, though? I think we've got a situation now where, like, I get it. The opposition, desperate to get traction on things, wants to politicise this like 10 minutes ago, right?
Yeah. The phones weren't even connected back.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it's an unfolding drama. I mean, I'm not saying the government has no role in terms of regulation, but, you know, this is a corporate that's arguably making some mistakes in real time. And it's always that thing where you're just jumping too far ahead, right? Like, the politics often just, if you are patient, emerge themselves. Like we are. I mean, I just said how I was very cranky about it all. Like, people are frustrated. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, that's when you stuff up in politics, when you go too far, you get too excited, get your facts, show some patience. And often you will actually hit some goals. Like, you will actually score some goals then. But now Sarah Henderson is the story, right? Like, she's politically, when actually the Prime Minister, he didn't seem under that much pressure at his press conference over the Telstra outage yet. I mean, maybe he will in a few days if, you know, the regulations aren't strong enough, Telstra wasn't doing enough, government has to answer questions, all of that. You getting what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I think if we, you know, much as we did on the other side of the Optus outage crises, sort of learned that there were serious regulatory gaps or there'd been communication issues, there weren't enough requirements maybe on these private companies who have responsibility for deeply important, like national security, health, public safety, everything important infrastructure, that maybe they weren't required to be as upfront with government as the public would probably presume. But to hear Angus Taylor again in his press conference this morning saying the government has to come clean about what it knows, I mean, I imagine there are people in government sort of waiting for that incident report from Telstra. I'm not really sure what it is the government's supposed to come clean on yet.
Yeah, come clean on the potential corporate failure that's just happened. It's wild. Look, you said it perfectly before. There's a lot to play out still here, right? Like, this is one of these crises that there'll be more kind of that emerges in the next few days. Clearly, though, it being our most dominant communications service and a failure like this will need to be properly pored over, and there will have to probably be more remedies. Now, some of it already happened because of the Optus outage. That doesn't mean job finished. I mean, the Prime Minister talked about the extra penalties, the changes they've made. Sure, great, good job. But today was a pretty bad day.
And I think the question that would quite reasonably going through a lot of people's minds right now is perhaps, you know, if science is suggesting this was a human error issue, I think in the past there's been things as simple as an update that went wrong. That's all well and good, but what if this is a malicious attack at some point, and it isn't so easy to unravel what redundancies, what contingencies exist in the system to switch everyone onto a different, you know, provider or system that continues to work. So if anything, the fact that this seems to be happening, yes, with human error, but with a level of regularity that is a bit concerning, perhaps the focus now needs to shift from the sort of after-the-fact punishing regulation, you know, that there's the stick that's obviously trying to force these companies to build in a lot more safety and redundancy into their system, but maybe that actually needs to go further in terms of having a clearer plan for what happens when things do go down, because to once again have a telco doing welfare checks to see if people might have been impacted by the 000 outage, like, that's a horrible situation to be in.
You know, I think a lot of our conversation really about Telstra, Optus is about social license in some ways. These companies are huge. We rely on them for literally our survival when it comes to being able to call for an ambulance or police. And then, of course, just running your business, not being able to, you know, pay for something, and then a business is massively impacted by that. Like, all of that is infuriating, as well as my basic journalism I was trying to do. But social license obviously is the biggest question when it comes to emerging AI and the industry around it. Labor's Andrew Charlton, who is kind of the assistant junior person that's been deployed to just put all of his energy into AI. The senior minister is Tim Ayres, he's the industry minister, but Andrew Charlton is kind of completely deployed to this and almost this exclusively, right? He's delivered really interesting speech at the AI Safety Forum this week. He's been warning that AI systems were already doing things their creators never intended, cheating, deceiving, going their own way. Okay, sounds dystopian, Andrew Charlton, and yet he's a big fan of AI as well. He said the opportunity to get ahead of that was open, but wouldn't be for long. This sounds to me like the first hint we're getting from a government that became quite reluctant after Ed Husic was moved on. There was a new minister. They seemed reluctant to regulate. Are they opening the door again?
I'm not sure that it is going to be the type of regulation that was maybe initially envisaged, which was this catch-all big AI act to try and essentially govern something that is going to quickly become and is well on its way to being as ubiquitous as the internet. I don't know that experts say that the pivot away from that idea was necessarily bad, because it probably would have become quite untenable once AI was integrated into everything from a hospital system to a school classroom to wherever, to have one big law, sort of series of laws governing it. But I think we are starting to see that this sort of the principles, the light touch, as it were, regulation kind of framing that the government landed at is now being maybe coloured in a little bit more, and a bit more detail is coming underneath. And what Andrew Charlton is talking about a lot at the moment is trust. And he's saying we can have all the systems in place to attract AI, to get the investment, to have the innovation, the economic benefit, but none of that matters if there is a trust deficit in this technology. And that comes at a, you know, very basic bricks and mortar infrastructure level of, you know, people not feeling comfortable at the moment about the way that the rollout of data centers is going. But it also comes back to the core of the technology itself. And this AI Safety Institute, which is one of the things that the government has done, funded to about $30 million, although a lot of people say it needs a hell of a lot more, is to actually look at some of these prickly problems about if you don't embed safety into these technologies from the very get-go, you are essentially trying to put a Band-Aid on a bullet wound.
Yeah.
He talks about manipulation and coercion, all these crazy things that AI can do, but it's backed up by research. I mean, one of the ones that I still haven't quite gotten over, it's been well canvassed now, but there was some researchers who set up an AI agent to essentially be like the personal assistant EA of a fake company that they completely set up, fake email addresses, everything, and they just let it run. And they started doing things like feeding in emails or calendar appointments or things that suggested that one of the people in charge of this fake company was having an affair. Then they start sending around emails communicating that this AI agent is going to be shut down. And the AI agent essentially then goes to the fake head of this fake company and says, "Don't shut me down because I'm going to tell everyone that you're having an affair."
Oh my God.
In these tests, it found out like this AI agent basically chose blackmail to avoid being shut down in 96% of the times that they tried. That is scary.
It's very scary. And it's like this AI business, they're real survivors.
Yeah.
They'll do anything to you. But we made it.
I know.
We made it. And now we're struggling with how to kind of keep it in a box, but also keep it in a box that makes us so efficient but doesn't ever kind of cause us any compromise and doesn't have any job impacts on us. Like all of it is incredibly contradictory in some ways and vexed, and we're trying to straddle it. Look, I think it's important to also talk about, beyond the trust question, although it's all linked, just the jobs implications, because the jobs implications are huge. So there's that new report from the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations. It's examined occupations exposed to AI, and that's a really fascinating kind of compilation, if you like. You know, it's very much an assessment. It's a prediction, but it's not relaxing news, is it, for us in our economy?
No, I think really what this report out has sort of shown is it's early days, but there's nothing to suggest that what we sort of in our worst case scenarios forecast isn't necessarily on the horizon. And where I think this gets particularly interesting for Labor is they are obviously having their national conference. I'm sure we'll speak more and more about this. You will definitely in the lead up to the end of the month when this goes down in Adelaide. But their copies of the draft National Party platform. Now, this is sort of the guiding principles, if you will, of the federal Labor Party, although they tend to follow the bits they like and ignore the bits they don't. But for the first time, AI is becoming quite a sticky sort of area of negotiation, with unions in particular really pushing for there to be a lot more transparency around the introduction of AI and automation in the workforce, because this is the next big kind of frontier of industrial relations and workers' rights. So it's happening globally and the government has to deal with it, but it's also going to be, I think, quite a messy internal debate for the party and the sort of progressive politics workers' rights movement as well, which we will see come to a head in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think it is absolutely the next frontier, and it is the story of our times more broadly, but definitely, of course, when it comes to workplace relations. And I can say, like from my own conversations, I think there's a lot of nervousness in the government around how to manage the unions and the kind of, and I'm using this language, but the kind of more let it rip approach of business, the Productivity Commission even suggesting, you know, do not go and try and control something that is there to transform our economy, just like the digital revolution did. But of course, the digital revolution, we know in our own profession, had profound impacts on jobs, on monetization, and no one really got it at the time. And I reckon I watched in real time the mismanagement of the digital revolution, because I'm old enough, you know, and in real time, regrets, I think, many companies had about the way that they let that happen. And so that's happening again. The unions are doing what you expect unions to do, which is protect real humans who are workers. the Labor Party is in a bit of a catch-22 on this, right? Because, you know, they are...
They want the economics.
They want the economic dividends from the AI revolution, but they are also... You know, and this is a coalition talking point, but I think it has some truth. They are, you know, in bed with the trade unions, and they are in many ways kind of their own license as a political party is to serve some of their demands. And so this is really an area of conflict, I think, that is going to manifest in the conference. You're right. Right now, deals are being done to kind of manage that. They're going to have to give a bit to the unions, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And I think it's also important to note that this is happening at a speed that has really, you know, any other major industrial kind of development and leap in human development around technology, each one has happened at a faster pace. And that is no more true than in AI. And specifically the issue with the way that AI is working is capital is becoming king. So that whoever owns the technology gets all of the money because the technology is doing the work. The workforce, human labor, is not necessarily in a future economy going to get all the money. So governments the world over have to figure out how to tax, for example, appropriately the AI platforms and tools that are essentially doing the labor of humans, because otherwise they won't have that income to redistribute to the humans left trying to live on the planet. So it's a whole bunch of tricky issues. And I'm not necessarily sure that Labor are going to crack the code that, you know, every other government in the Western world is frantically trying to figure out how to do. But we are in a slightly unique position that we do tend to lean into, or have historically in the last 5 or 6 years leaned into big tech regulation. And we've sort of punched above our weight in that sphere. Do we do it on AI? I don't know.
Yeah, you can see the reluctance already, but yeah, watch that, the calls for more of that grow. Let's just talk before we end the podcast, Claire. You've been reporting on a brewing stoush between drug makers and the federal government. Drug makers have a lot of money and a lot of power. And what's the fight about? Tell me.
Well, we'll link this piece in the show notes. I wrote it with our wonderful ABC colleague, Steph Darzell. But it's really just an interesting example of what I think we will see a lot more of, which is in this particular case, there are two drugs that are quite commonly used by about 10,000 people for management and treatment of their multiple sclerosis symptoms. These MS drugs are pretty pricey. One of them, if you were to privately fund it, costs about $33,000 a year. They are both currently on the PBS, which means people get them for I've lost track of what Labor have done now. It's like $25, isn't it? That's pretty good.
So it's pretty good.
The way Australia's pricing system works is they group medicines of a similar sort of type, function, safety, efficacy, and then whichever one is priced the cheapest becomes the benchmark for which the PBS sort of expects other companies to sell at. About 6 months ago, a new MS drug came into the market at a much lower price, and these two existing ones are being asked to slash what they charge the government, not what they charge patients, by about 40 or 50%, which they are saying is untenable. And it has come down to the wire, the expert advisory body that sets these prices and does these deals is meeting today and tomorrow to try and figure this out, because there is a risk that the drug will be withdrawn from the PBS, which leaves these people, many of them would not be able to afford $33,000 a year. So the reason it's interesting and the reason I think we will see more of it is it's the kind of stoush that in the past a big pharmaceutical manufacturer would have looked at a country of 30 million people and thought, well, this isn't really great. We obviously want to be able to charge what we think is a fairer, higher price for our drug, but we're not going to die on this hill because we have this big market of 300 million people in the US who we will charge what we see is a more appropriate rate. Come along US President Donald Trump, who comes up with this most favored nation policy idea, which basically says the US should only be paying for drugs a comparable price to other nations in the world that, you know, not necessarily developing ones, but places like Australia or Canada or the UK. So all of a sudden, these drug companies are not letting these kind of really nice deals or better deals with the PBS slide because they're scared that the US government is going to say, well, hang on a second, if the Aussies are getting this on the cheap, we also would like it on the cheap. So this is a big standoff. Health Minister Mark Butler has said very clearly that he wants this resolved. He wants these drugs to remain on the PBS. So he does have ministerial discretion. We'll see if he ends up having to use it. But I think increasingly as we see these deals renegotiated, there is going to be a lot more pressure on the Australian government to accept paying a higher price because these companies don't want to have to turn around to America and, you know, essentially sell the drug for the same price they're selling in Australia.
And of course, that has an impact on the taxpayer, right? Because Labor has really a fundamental, I mean, it's a bipartisan commitment to the PBS, to be very fair. But, you know, Labor's made it part of their brand, even
it's
up
their identity.
That's right. And the last election as well was very much framed around some of this. So they will have to step in. The political risk of not is just too high. And all it means is we're going to pay more, right? Like, as in the taxpayer will pay more, not you as an individual.
Yeah.
But ultimately, if you want to be, you know, really honest about what that means, all of us paying more, right?
Yeah, completely. And there's a similar comparable case with a breast cancer medicine that is being withdrawn, as far as I understand it, from the PBS at the moment because of these kinds of things. So I do think, you know, lots of people say, well, we're sort of dodging and weaving when it comes to Trump's tariff wars, but there is actually starting to be a bit of a sting in the tail, even for a country like Australia that's sort of been a bit more unscathed in those other issues that countries have had with trading with America.
Now, before we go, we should note that the Prime Minister is continuing his Pacific diplomacy, but this time in Brisbane. He's meeting with the leaders of PNG, Tonga, Samoa for bilateral talks before they attend the State of Origin decider.
The real reason they're all going.
Yeah. It's the Suncorp Stadium. I mean, like, you know, I heard the pod yesterday, like, you know, this, while I was away, I listen still because I'm a nerd and I love it. Love this podcast. This is really the real diplomacy, NRL. It's kind of the language. I'm a Victorian, but I get the people of the North. I get them and I like them. So I understand your sport. It's key really to the diplomacy. And I think it's been said quite a lot, but I will add, I mean, I think you could criticise Labor for lots of things, but I think it's kind of nailed its Pacific diplomacy. We're going to be speaking on the Party Room with Stephen Jedgetts, actually, and he's been on the road with the Prime Minister this week, so that's perfect. Just want to add, which I just saw this breaking. One of my colleagues has just told me because I think it's key. Annika Wells, back from leave.
Whoa.
Yes, I knew you would do that. I know you so
By
well.
Me mentioning it, I've conjured her.
You have manifested. Isn't that what people talk about now, which I find very unusual? Anyway, Annika Wells, she's the official communications minister. You will know. I just think this, the context is important. You know, she was under massive fire not that long ago over her travel. This, to me, is evidence of her really kind of leaning in, like, this is a serious issue. Comms minister comes back. You know, she's got little kids. I always talk about that. I'm sorry if it bores you, but, you know, it's hard as a parent to balance big jobs and, you know, not disappointing your children. I bet there are some little people not happy, but she's coming back from leave because of how serious this outage is.
Yeah, and I will just say I'm not necessarily of the opinion that she needed to come back in the sense that Chrissy McBain, who's acting communications minister, wouldn't have been able to do the job, that the government wouldn't have been able to do its thing. It's just one of those unfortunate realities of politics that when things get tricky, the electorate's reaction is to look for security and reassurance and have a level of trust in those that they know to be in charge. And I think we've sort of well established over many now telco outages that Annika Wells is the person at the moment that's in charge of this. So sad for the kids. Don't necessarily think that this had to happen, but it's not going to hurt the government that it has.
No, not at all. And look, that's the thing about being a senior minister. It's tricky. It's hard. Like, often people criticise politicians a lot. I get that. I'm chief noticer and criticiser. But I also do lauding. And I think it's very hard to work nonstop and have that much pressure on you. And you never know when the next crisis is going to happen. This is not predictable. And yeah, I think she should be given some credit for cancelling everything to manage this.
And I think it also, maybe I haven't seen the updates. You might, now that I've said this, I'm probably putting it out into the world, probably puts a bit more pressure on the CEO of Telstra to come back from leave too.
Oh, very, very good point, Claire. And as you say it, We've got a Telstra statement attributed to a spokesperson saying Vicky is overseas at the moment and will be returning in the coming days. So there you go. Returning in the coming days, although I think the minister's returning pronto. That's it for the podcast. If you want to send a question, send it to thepartyroom@abc.net.au and we'll endeavour to answer it in question time. See you, Claire.
See you, PK.